You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup with a look at the latest from the devastating wildfire in Hawaii to the big indictments in Georgia. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, for the first time, a woman was set to join the highest group of American military leaders this week. Admiral Lisa Franchetti was nominated to replace Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Mike Gilday and join the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Her nomination, though, is one of more than 300 position changes held in limbo by a standoff between the Biden administration and Department of Defense, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville from Alabama. That number comes from data obtained and verified by the Washington Post. Tuberville in February objected to moving forward with what is normally a bipartisan procedure to approve numerous military confirmations and promotions all at once. That was in response to the Pentagon's shift in policy following last year's Dobbs Supreme Court decision to provide paid leave and reimburse travel expenses incurred by service members who cross state lines for legal abortion care. Here's Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin speaking on Monday.
Because of this blanket hold, starting today, for the first time in the history of the Department of Defense, three of our military services are operating without Senate-confirmed leaders. This is unprecedented. It is unnecessary, and it is unsafe. And this sweeping hold is undermining America's military readiness. It's hindering our ability to retain our very best officers. And it is upending the lives of far too many American military families.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story since February? What are your thoughts on it? Do you think the Pentagon made the right move changing its policy? What do you think of Senator Tuberville's decision to hold up votes because of this policy? If you are or a family member is in the military, what do you think about all of this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter Fever is a professor of political science at Duke University, director of the Duke Program in American Grand Strategy, and professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy. He's the author of a new book called Thanks for Your Service, The Causes and Consequences of Public Confidence in the U.S. Military. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the impact of all of this, let's start with the policy dispute at the center of this. You mentioned to our producer, you think there is a legitimate policy discussion to be had about this Pentagon policy to reimburse travel for service members seeking abortion.
Yes, I do think that reasonable people can differ on the underlying policy disagreement that drove Senator Tuberville to take pretty drastic action. What the DOD did was in response to the new world that we live in under Dobbs. So when Roe v. Wade, abortion care was the same across all states. And when that was changed by the Supreme Court under the Dobbs decision, states could have different abortion policies. That meant that a military person who was assigned to be in the state, didn't have a choice about what state they'd be in, might find themselves with very different healthcare options just by virtue of different actions by the state. In response to that, the Department of Defense made the decision that said they would cover the costs for a person to travel to another state to seek whatever healthcare options they wanted that would be legal in those other states. Here's the rub. By doing so, that upended a implicit sort of agreement between pro-life and pro-choice activists under the Roe v. Wade era that said we won't use taxpayer dollars to fund abortions. Of course, that was a compromise struck under the Roe era, and they just didn't forge a new compromise under Dobbs. And when the Department of Defense took this action, it kind of forced the issue. Senator Tuberville responded in a very dramatic way. And while there's precedent for putting holds on large numbers of officers, there's no precedent for something this sweeping, lasting this long, that we are in uncharted territory today.
People might look at this and say, well, they can have interim people in all of these positions. We'll look at some of the effective positions in a bit. But is this just a bureaucratic distinction? All the work is getting done, so not a big deal?
No, it's much more serious than that. For one thing, the Senate demands that people who have been nominated but not confirmed demands that they do not take any action that would presume upon Senate confirmation. So they are frozen. The actings are more junior officers who are temporarily acting in the place of the one more senior who is frozen. However, several of the actings were the ones nominated to take over the higher position. So, for instance, the chief of staff of the Army is someone who had been vice chief. And so he is tapped to be the acting chief. But because of the Senate rule, he's not allowed to take action that would presume he would be confirmed as chief. So he's acting chief, but he doesn't have the full authority that an acting chief would have. And an acting chief doesn't have the full authority and scope of action that a confirmed chief has. So there's a lot of uncertainty that's rippling through the ranks just within the U.S. military. But then if you think about how our senior military in many of these positions have a key role of interacting with our allies and partners and engaging with our adversaries, you know, in sitting across the table, perhaps, and talking to them on tough issues. But if they're acting and not confirmed, then they're limited in what they can say and do. And so it's freezing the activities of our allies and partners, and it's giving a big advantage to our adversaries. So it may seem like it's a bureaucratic interruption. If this had happened for just, you know, a week or two, that's all it would have been. But now that we're into this going on for many months and we've reached 300, this is a deep blow to military readiness.
Do you have particular concerns with people in the Asian region who might be dealing with, say, China?
Well, if you look, you know, people have asked me, what are the most serious ones? Well, of course, everyone would say the top names, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's frozen right now. President Biden nominated C.Q. Brown. By all expectations, the Senate will confirm him if the hold were lifted. So he is frozen. Several of the chiefs of staff of the services are frozen. Those have big symbolic as well as material consequences. But if you look more deeply at just the Indo-PACOM theater, there's a lot of warfighting admirals and generals who are sort of poised to take policy and advance it and advance the preparedness of our forces in the Indo-PACOM theater, which, of course, is where we face our pacing challenge in China. They aren't able to act. And so this is a gift to China, a gift that keeps giving every day by putting us on our hind legs and giving an advantage to them, the number of frozen warfighters in the Indo-PACOM theater.
Talking to Peter Fever from Duke University, looking at this block on key appointments and promotions in the U.S. military over a policy dispute about compensation from the military for travel expenses related to abortion. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, reactions, and questions. Let's bring on a caller now. Rod is with us in Madison. Rod, hi. Are you there, Rod?
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. Yep, what did you want to bring up?
Yes sir. I'm not opinionated either way, but I am just taking the comment by the Secretary of Defense a little bit, in my opinion. I felt out of line because the senator, in my opinion, and this is what I would like to comment of your guest, they, by definition, they are acting on the wish and the will of their constituents. So to assume that this is just primarily politically motivated and not looking at what prompted that action. And the other thing is the notion that these chiefs will have issue with career. I mean, where else would they go to be hired to work? So I don't understand this comment, the Secretary of Defense, that this is their career issue. So I'm going to stop talking and listen. Thank you very much for letting me talk here.
Rod, thanks for the call. Peter, Rod's first point saying, you know, this is a political dispute, questioning, I think, the tactics here. Do you see maybe a more productive way to have this legitimate, as you say, policy dispute without this embargo?
Well, there's no question that this has become a political football now. I think it has been working for Senator Tuberville in a political sense. He has gone from being an obscure junior senator to being the subject of multiple news stories, including Wisconsin Public Radio. So he's gained in stature. As a consequence, he's been able to raise a lot of do a lot of fundraising off this issue. And for one wing of the sort of the MAGO Rhino establishment, he's celebrated. So it's working narrowly in a narrow political sense for him. Whether it's in fact popular among his constituents in Alabama, I think the polling data suggests that it depends very much on how you frame the question to the Alabama voters as to whether they support this or not. But it is, you know, it is working for him politically. Now, what the caller also suggested was that these generals and admirals have nowhere to go, so they'll just wait it out and we won't lose anyone. Unfortunately, that's just not the case. All of these senior military leaders have many good options on the outside. And while I'm not so much worried about losing the ones who have been nominated and are frozen, I think they will stay. I think where we'll see the drain is in the next level down. And think about all the family conversations around the kitchen table as the spouses are saying, should we stay in for another 3-4 years and try to get that next promotion? And then they are looking at this happening, and this tilts the internal calculation towards, now let's leave. Why should we subject our family to another move, to all the disruptions, only to find ourselves frozen in place? And that, let me just make one further point about this. We're not just freezing 300 general and flag officers. We're freezing thousands of family members who also can't move, don't know whether they're going to go to high school here or whether they'll never get confirmed, and so they have to go to high school there. Whether the spouse should try to get a job here or there, all of those decisions are on hold. So the impact is rippling through the community and I think reaching down into lower ranks. And I worry about its impact on retention going forward.
Thanks for that call, Rod. We're talking to Peter Fever, political science professor at Duke University, looking at this ongoing standoff between a Republican senator and the U.S. military over its policy supporting service members who want to seek abortion care in states where it's still legal to do so, and a block on many key promotions and appointments in the military. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? How would you like to see this all resolved? Are you a member of the military or a family member or a former military member? What does this look like to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Peter Fever, professor of political science at Duke University, looking at stalled leadership confirmations and promotions across the branches of the U.S. military, how they're affecting national defense. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Brenda is with us in Menominee. Brenda, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about?
I just want to know, how is it that one senator has the power to hold up all these confirmations?
Great question, Brenda. Peter, why is it that it works this way?
So this has to do with the arcane rules of the Senate, and it's a courtesy. The Senate could eliminate this if they chose, but that would be considered something like a nuclear option. It would destroy the powers of every senator. And so the Senate is unwilling to do that because every senator has used holds at some point or other to influence their negotiations with the administration. In that extent, this is not unusual. It's not unusual for a senator to squeeze the administration through the hold process in order to get some concession. What's unusual is the scope and the length of this one. Now, the way it works, the Senate could force through votes on the nominations, but they'd have to do them one at a time. And that would take a tremendous amount of floor time. Indeed, to get through all 300 now, it'd probably take all of the remaining floor time that the Senate has in this session. And so it's just not workable. Some people expected, I expected, that Senator Schumer, who's the leader of the Senate, would have kept senators in D.C. during August. So not give them a recess and just force them to go through the onerous process of voting one by one by one, at least for some of the more senior names. And doing so would have put pressure on Senator Tuberville, because it would have made 99 other senators mad that they were missing their chance to go back and campaign in the district. They were forced to go through what is, scut work from the Senate's point of view. Senator Schumer opted not to do that. And that was a missed opportunity, I think, to put pressure and maybe change the calculation within the Republican caucus as to whether to continue to support Senator Tuberville.
Brenda, thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us now in Eau Claire. Chris, what did you want to bring up?
It's kind of more of a comment. I'm a former enlisted member of the military, the Air Force, and it boggles my mind that a senator would want to inhibit our foreign protection and against for adversaries, and then just beat some domestic policy to a dead horse when you can easily, at least in my mind, separate those two things. Domestic issues can be dealt with long term, but you kind of do what you got to do to make sure that the military is ready to go at any point in time. So that's just my comment.
Chris, thanks for the call. Peter, what do you think?
Well, one of the questions that's kept this dispute going for so long is that we don't know what Senator Tuberville would accept as a compromise. So what he has said is the only deal he'll accept is if DOD completely reverses course and surrenders, basically, to his view. He had a chance to have a vote on the floor, a vote in the Senate on the policy issue and he could have created a law that would have forced DOD to accept his preferred policy. That's within the power of Congress to do. But Senator Tuberville chose not to do that. He's trying to force the DOD just to back down. And that raises the question, maybe Senator Tuberville doesn't really have his own idea of how to get out of this. I think he may be stuck in the same dead end that the we all are stuck in, and he doesn't know a way out. Because if the only thing he's proposing is that DOD completely surrender to his perspective, well, the DOD is not going to do that. President Biden has said he's not going to do that. Secretary Austin has said they're not going to do that. And so what is the compromise that Senator Tuberville would accept? Hard to see at this stage.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Peter Fever from Duke University about this block on about 300 plus now key appointments in the U.S. military. Back to your calls. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. Under the previous administration, there was a discussion about moving the Space Force Command from Colorado to Alabama. And now under the current administration, that has been tabled indefinitely, and the Space Force Command was said to be staying in Colorado. Now, Senator Tuberville seems to have come out with this kind of drastic policy of, blocking these confirmations, in my view, almost retaliatory move to kind of force maybe some more discussion around the move of the Space Command.
Chris, thanks for the call. I think the timing here, though, is Tuberville's blockade of these appointments started months ago, I think, and that Space Command decision became public at the end of July. So there have been some accusations that the Biden administration was retaliating over this. What do you think of all that, Peter?
Well, a lot of people thought that there might be a deal in March, April timeframe, before this thing became the juggernaut for fundraising that it has become, before it became elevated to such a high culture war level, that maybe what Senator Tuberville really wanted was to get the headquarters moved to Alabama. There was a reasonable argument to move it to Alabama, and that you know, some members actually of the Biden administration actually supported that, while the majority, at least the president anyway, decided to go the other way. The problem is now that we've reached this stage of the standoff, I think it's very unlikely that the Biden administration would reverse course on the Space Force headquarters decision. And so that deal, which may have been available in March, April, no longer available. And this really speaks to the larger issue here. We've got to stop making the military combatants in our culture wars. There's a legitimate debate about what is the appropriate abortion care policy. Reasonable people can debate how to handle that. But what we've done now is we're targeting the uniformed military and making them combatants in that culture war. We got to get Republicans to stop targeting the military. We got to get Democrats, Biden administration, to stop hiding behind the military. Maybe we also have to get the military to learn how to talk about their values without sounding like culture war combatants. But we got to move to a point where the military is not targeted in these culture wars.
Peter, thanks for joining us. I think we'll have you back to talk about your new book and maybe pick up on that very point.
Well, thank you. I look forward to that chance.
That's Peter Feaver, professor of political science at Duke University. We talked to him today about military readiness as Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama holds up hundreds of promotions and leadership confirmations in protest of a Defense Department policy to support service members seeking abortion care in states where it's still legal. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a guest makes the case that Wisconsin needs to do more to protect election workers from public threats. And some clinics in Wisconsin are using the drug ketamine to try to treat mental health concerns, PTSD, and more. But the practice is still in early days with a lot of questions. A UW researcher joins the show with a look at ketamine. That and more Monday on Central Time. First, extreme heat has covered huge parts of the United States for long stretches of time over the course of this summer. As of just yesterday, over 60 million people in the U.S. were under heat alerts, and that zone of high heat is expected to continue and expand over the weekend. Extreme heat can be lethal, but we don't always take it seriously. Why? Our next guest says that heat waves and global warming in general have a PR problem. He says that phrases like global warming and extreme heat don't capture the true scale and depth of destruction and threat to human and animal lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived in parts of the country with extreme heat? Have you seen them getting more extreme? Have you noticed summer's getting hotter, winter's getting warmer, summer nights not getting as cool? Join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked outside in high heat? What is that like? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff Goodell is a journalist and author. He's covered climate change for more than two decades. His new book is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. It's a New York Times bestseller. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, Jeff, you've been covering climate change, global warming for a couple decades now. This book, I think, is looking to turn up our sense of urgency a little bit. Can you talk about what you're trying to communicate here?
Well, you're exactly right. I am trying to turn up the urgency a little bit. And it came out of a personal experience of mine. You know, I've been writing about climate change for more than 10 years and, you know, thought a lot about heat in the sense of global warming, the general idea of a warming planet. But the immediacy and risk of it was not anything I really thought about until I took a walk of about 15 blocks on a 115 degree day in Phoenix, Arizona. And by the time I got to my destination at the other side of town, you know, I was feeling lightheaded and my heart was pounding. And I really realized that heat is a real immediate risk to people's lives. And the book was sort of born out of that experience. And I wanted to explore what heat means to us in the here and now as we live on this rapidly warming planet.
That reminds me that walk in Phoenix, you write that the human body, we have to think of it as a heat machine, and this delicate machine functions in a narrow area, kind of a Goldilocks zone, you say, of temperature conditions.
Yeah, I mean, we've evolved over the last, you know, several million years to in a relatively narrow band of temperature. You know, there's been, you know, hotter and colder times, but Our body is tuned to a particular climate. And what's happening now is as things get hotter and hotter, we're moving out of that temperature bounds. And our body is really good at regulating its temperature. We don't have to think about it, right? You don't have to remind yourself to keep your body temperature at 98.6 degrees. Our body just does it. And we have a mechanism which we use to maintain that internal body temperature, which is sweat. Everyone knows that. But there's at a certain point when either you don't sweat enough because you have become dehydrated, or if the temperature gets beyond what the sweat can deal with, that you get in trouble because your internal body temperature starts to rise. So it's basically about moving out of this zone of comfort that our body is so finely tuned over evolutionary time to deal with.
You talk about two different types of heat stroke. Neither of them sound good. It's a difficult read in some cases. Can you tell us about classic and exertional heat stroke and how they affect us?
Right. So the two different types of heat stroke, a classic heat stroke is the simplest explanation is, kind of what happens to a child if you leave them, or a person, or an adult for that matter, but it's most often children that are sadly victims of this in a hot car. It is a You're just in a hot environment and your body can't compensate for that heat, and your internal blood internal body temperature rises and rises. You can sweat as much as you want, but the heat is so extreme that your body can't cool itself off, and that puts tremendous strain on the heart. Different people have different kind of vulnerabilities to it, depending on how strong their heart is and things like that. But eventually, at a certain point, it will kill anyone. Exertional heat stroke is an entirely different thing. Exertional heat stroke is the kind of thing that happens to outdoor workers a lot, farm workers, delivery people, athletes, in fact, who are out, exerting themselves. When you're exercising, you're generating a lot of internal body heat that adds to the outside heat that you're experiencing from the hot day, and that can be extremely dangerous also for the same kinds of reasons, is that you're reaching a body temperature that you can no longer dissipate the heat from, and it's putting tremendous strain on your heart and circulatory system, and if you don't find relief, you're in big trouble.
We're talking to Jeff Goodell, author of the new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff, you live in Texas, a place known for heat, but Texas, parts of Texas are hitting records this year. Phoenix, were you talking about that walk, a hot place getting hotter. What is extreme heat looking like in places that were already pretty hot?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Austin right now, sitting here. It's 108 degrees. It's been over 102 degrees for, I think, 30 days now here. We're seeing these longer and longer heat waves that are hotter and hotter. And these are not really unexpected. These are within the kinds of climate that scientists have long been telling us we are going to be experiencing as we continue to burn fossil fuels, which puts CO2 into the atmosphere, which is raising the temperatures on the planet. On an average, they're rising, but also it is creating these more extreme weather events. And this additional warmth causes these more extreme heat waves, like we're seeing here. We're seeing heat waves in unexpected places, the Pacific Northwest in 2021. Wisconsin is not known, of course, as a place where you've experienced a lot of extreme heat waves, but it is now in this sort of new climate a place where I would not be surprised to see temperatures far beyond what you're used to at some point in the not so distant future. And so it's sort of the rising warmth of our planet has changed the sort of atmospheric dynamics so that these extreme events are much more common and much more unexpected.
You also visited Antarctica, not a place we think of as hot, but By Antarctic standards, it's had extreme heat, and that could have very dangerous effects for us. What did you see there?
Yeah, Antarctica is a place that's, you know, long been thought of as a very cold, very stable place, where the larger warming of the planet has been very slow to reach for various reasons that were not worth going into. You know, the Arctic to the north has been warming basically four times faster than the rest of the planet, but Antarctica to the south has not been. And so there was a lot of thought that, you know, Antarctica was a kind of stable exception to this sort of larger warming. But I went down there because I had, I learned about some research some scientists were doing about the temperature changes in the ocean. And we talk about temperature changes, we're often talking about land temperature, which is where we live, and so that's what we think about. But ocean temperatures are really important. And what's happening in Antarctica is that the Southern Ocean, the temperature there, the average temperature there has risen just 1 degree Fahrenheit, which is hardly, you would think, hardly noticeable. But it has changed the melt rate of the bottom of the glaciers, where the glaciers meet the sea, and allowed the ocean water to get underneath these glaciers, and is destabilizing these enormous glaciers in Antarctica. And this has huge consequences for every kind of coastal city in the world, because as these big glaciers melt and collapse into the sea, they accelerate sea level rise. And so the point that why I wanted to go there is to show that even small changes in temperature in places like the Southern Ocean can have enormous implications.
We're talking to journalist Jeff Goodell about his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it's hot, do you rely on air conditioning, maybe for a medical condition or other risk factors for heat stroke? Do you worry as you watch these rising temperatures around the country? Have you experienced high heat, maybe working outside yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist Jeff Goodell about his new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What action, if any, do you want to see taken when it comes to climate change and fossil fuel emissions? Do you feel optimistic that we can deal with rising temperatures, or are you worried? Did you move here, maybe to Wisconsin, from a hot place at some point in your life, in part because of worries about the heat? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff, I want to talk about how we talk about heat. You write in the book, you know, hot is a euphemism for sexy. Warming sounds kind of nice. It's hard to take pictures of climate change as opposed, or of extreme heat in particular, as opposed to the impact of a hurricane or an earthquake or something like that. Is part of the story a communications problem here?
Yeah, it is, and it's a deep and complex communications problem. I mean, you know, things, other kind of climate related, you know, events like, you know, hurricanes, droughts, all those kinds of things are very easy to visualize. We see them. We know, you know, we can tell looking out our window if the wind is blowing 20 miles an hour or 120 miles an hour. It looks very different. You know, roofs are flying off houses at 120 miles an hour. Heat, you know, I'm looking out my window in Austin right now and I can't tell if it's 70 degrees out there or 120 degrees. It looks exactly the same. So there's no visual, you know, messaging that helps us understand the risks of heat. It's only when, like I did on my walk in Phoenix, you go out and your heart starts pounding and you start feeling lightheaded and you think, oh my gosh, this is dangerous. I'm in trouble. And so, this is, you know, part of the problem with the way we talk about global warming. Global warming just sounds like better beach weather. It doesn't sound like very worrisome at all. So, and people talk about, scientists talk about, you know, 2 degrees of warming. And to most people, 2 degrees of warming just sounds like nothing. It's like the difference between a 78 degree day and an 80 degree day. It doesn't sound worrisome at all. So there's a lot of problems in how we have come to understand and calculate the sort of risks of this warming that we're experiencing.
you also focus on who is hardest hit by extreme heat. If you can afford in a hot place like Texas or Phoenix to have air conditioning and stay inside it, it may not feel like a big deal. But you look at migrant workers who work in fields or people who live in Chennai, India, in shacks. Talk about how the impacts are unevenly distributed.
Yeah, in the book, I talk about a kind of bright line between the cooled and the damned, meaning people who have access to refuge on hot days and in hot weather, who are privileged enough not to have to work outdoors and experience the heat, and who don't have to make a choice between, you know, being productive in their jobs and, you know, risking their lives to do it. You know, the people who are most, you know, heat is predatory. It goes after people who are, you know, have weaker hearts, who have poor circulatory systems, who are forced to work outside. I mean, I'm here in Texas and I look at these workers outside, you know, in the middle of, on a day like today, 106 degrees, who are working on the rooftops, putting on new roofs and stuff. And the kind of what the risks that they're dealing with in doing that kind of thing. Farm workers too. I write about the death of a farm worker in Oregon due to the fact that he was out in a field working on an extremely hot day. He knew he was at risk. He knew the dangers of extreme heat, but he also knew that if he took a shade break, started and took breaks to drink water, he would likely be fired. And there's no labor laws protecting at that time in Oregon. There have been some passed now, but there were no laws protecting the workers from these extreme heat conditions, insisting on breaks for 10 minutes every hour or something like that. So there's a real, you know, it's really easy to say, oh yeah, just get everybody air conditioning and it'll be fine. But that's not the way the real world is going to work.
Talking to Jeff Goodell about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Jeff, I want to talk about some solutions you look at in the book. And on the communications front, things like naming our heat waves and other communications efforts to communicate the impact of these extreme events. Where do you see success stories?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, this question about kind of just getting smart about the risk of heat and understanding how dangerous it is, understanding why dry heat is less dangerous than wet heat, for example, because of the wet heat, it's more difficult for your sweat to evaporate. Getting better with a kind of media messaging and public health messaging. I mean, think about what happens when you have a tornado coming through, or when you have, if you live on the coast, a hurricane. The government has all kinds of ranking systems, you know, category one, category two, category three. It tells you immediately a lot about the wind speed, about the risks. You have a lot of information about evacuation routes. You have everybody knows kind of what to do. It's drilled into their heads in a very clear way. The entire government mobilizes around keeping people safe. That does not happen during heat waves. At most, you might get some kind of alert on your phone, but there's no sense of what to do, where to go, how dangerous is it? Is it a really bad heat wave? Is it not? So I think there can be a lot done just in the simple sense of preparing and educating people for what to do during heat waves. And then there's things like, of course, cutting fossil fuel consumption, because that's what's driving the heat. Building cities with more green spaces, more nature in cities, more shade, more refuge for people. Here in Austin, we have like a public park with a big pool, a natural spring in it that is a haven during hot days. Things like that that allow people access to public spaces that are cooler during hot weather.
Do you see widespread efforts to do that in communities to take, these cities that are already heat islands in some ways, more so as climate change heats them up more, to combat that heat island phenomenon?
Yeah, you know, there's beginning to be efforts, but I mean, let's be frank. I mean, it's, you know, cities are built over many decades, if not centuries. It's going to take a long time to refashion a place like Phoenix or a place like Austin. And, you know, it's going to take a long time to change the sort of physical geography of these kinds of places. It's going to take a long time for people to figure out ways to get more air conditioning to people who can't afford it. And, in certain ways, places like some of the studies have shown, the mortality studies of heat waves have shown that places like Madison and northern cities who really are not equipped to deal with heat at all, who don't, people don't think about heat waves, that they don't have, just like when the ice storm hit Texas. If you live in Wisconsin, you know how to deal with an ice storm. An ice storm hit Texas, 2 years ago when I was here, and people just freaked out. They had no idea what to do. And so there's a strong case to be made that northern cities are sort of, people who live in northern cities are kind of more at risk from these sort of freakish and extreme and increasingly hot weather patterns that are going to be emerging in the future than places in heat savvy cities like Austin. Even though the temperatures and stuff might be higher, at least there's a higher level of knowledge of what to do during these kinds of extreme conditions.
You talked to one expert in one of your visits to Phoenix, I think it was, who was warning of, a Katrina-level heat event if one of these heat waves coincides with a power outage. What are the worst-case scenarios people are worried about?
Well, they're pretty horrific. One of the things about air conditioning is, everyone thinks that, I have air conditioning, I don't have to worry about any of this. Whatever the temperature is, I'll just crank up my AC and it's all fine. But that works well as long as the grid is up and stable. During extreme heat events, the grid load is very, very high. We're feeling that in Texas right now. Yesterday, I think, was a record-breaking demand on the Texas grid. Thank God it was stable. But during these kinds of events, the grid is liable is more vulnerable to blackouts. And if you have a massive blackout, which has happened, it happened here in Texas in the winter. If you had a 2 or 3 day blackout, you could have massive casualties. I mean, one study that I cited in my book talks about 80,000 people dying in a city like Phoenix over if there was a blackout that lasted more than 36 hours. Because what happens is, we've built, especially in these hot cities, we've built these buildings with sealed windows. You can't open the windows. They work fine if there is air conditioning, but if the air conditioning fails and the power fails, then they become convection ovens and there's nowhere to go. And it's a kind of horrific scenario.
Did you, in our last minute or so, Jeff, come out of this long project leading to the heat will kill you first with any sense of optimism?
I do. I actually am some people have been critical of me of being sort of excessively optimistic, but I really do think that, heat is really this, these heat waves we're seeing is really driving home to millions of people that climate change is not a far off distant event. It's really happening fast. It's happening now. Our lives are at stake, and that we can make changes to do things differently. We can get our energy from a different place. We can build cities in different ways. We can grow food in different ways. There's a lot of possibility for kind of building a better world, but we have to be engaged. We have to understand the risks that we face, and we have to get politically involved because this is not just about technology and culture. This is also about politics.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jeff Goodell, journalist and author. He talked to us about his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First: Life and Death on a Scorched Planet.